The views expressed in the following podcast are not necessarily the views of the United States Air Force or the Air Force Reserve, but rather the perspectives of the individual speakers. No endorsement of any particular person, business, or interest is ever intended.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Ready, Set, Airlift. I'm your host, Julian Hernandez, from the 433rd Airlift Wing Public Affairs team. I recently had the chance to speak with two women who made history during their Air Force careers. Their accomplishments as pilots helped pave the way for future generations of airmen, and they shared some reflections of their time in uniform following a recent visit to Starbase Kelly, which is part of a DoD program to introduce science, technology, engineering, and math to underprivileged elementary school students. Starbase Kelly is housed in the Alamo Wing footprint, and many of our reserve citizen airmen contribute in various ways. Two very special guests with me here today. We have retired Lieutenant Colonel Olga Custodio, the first female Hispanic pilot in the United States military, and retired Lieutenant Colonel Carolyn Blaze Jansen, the first female reserve officer to fly with the Thunderbirds. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining and making time for this conversation today. Lieutenant Colonel Custodio, I want to start with you. Why did you join the Air Force?
Well, very simple for me. I'm an Army brat, grew up around the world. I saw my father as a professional soldier, and he was my role model. And I saw that he was serving our country, and I wanted to follow his footsteps. So that's what motivated me to join. Obviously, I decided the Air Force was a better fit than the Army, and my dad was okay with that. But his professional job in the Army was in communications. So because of that, his assignments were overseas. So I got to live in Taiwan and Iran and in Paraguay and South America, and it really taught me a lot. And I felt like I was an ambassador, as well as my dad, to our, not so much the military, but as a U.S. citizen. So I felt like I was able to see how people saw us and interact with other cultures and in different countries. And it really motivated me to pursue the fact that I wanted to join the service and do what my dad did. So that was my motivation.
Colonel Jansen, I had the benefit of hearing you speak last week here to the students of Starbase Kelly, so I know the answer for you on why you joined the Air Force. But of course, for the benefit of the audience, tell us why you joined the Air Force.
Yeah, my story is similar to Olga's story. I grew up with my grandparents. My mom's mother was actually in the Coast Guard. She worked as a SPAR, and those women did like clerical duty on the shore so that men in the Coast Guard could deploy to war. And then my dad's father, my grandpa on my dad's side, also served during World War II. And he was on a Coast Guard cutter called the Duane in the North Atlantic. And they were shooting and capturing German submarines and a lot of really combatant type experiences that you wouldn't normally think of the Coast Guard, but that's the way it was during World War II. And then my father was in the Marine Corps during Vietnam, and he flew helicopters. I was born in Wisconsin, and we lived on a farm, and my parents divorced when I was about 7 years old, and my dad went full-time into the Minnesota Air National Guard. And so I'd go and visit him, and we'd get to go out to the airfield, and we'd see static line drops out the back of C-130s, and my dad flew helicopters with Hueys there. So I was always like really enamored with the thought of serving because of my family, and just had a lifelong kind of love of flying since I saw an airplane flying around the clouds in a movie when I was about 6 years old. My dad definitely wanted me and helped me and encouraged me to fly, but he always said he wanted me to fly something higher and faster than a helicopter. He had over 630 combat missions in Vietnam, and wow, a lot of the guys that he flew with didn't make it through. So he wanted me to do that, but to do it safely, and was all for me joining the Air Force.
So for both of you, such a rich family legacy of service and a deep understanding from a young age of what service means and its importance. And as I mentioned in the introduction, both of you in your own ways really have had historic journeys through your service. And so I'd like to start with you, Colonel Jensen. Tell us about how you became the first female reserve officer to fly with the Thunderbirds.
It was almost an accident. I am a 1998 graduate from the Air Force Academy, and I had seen the Thunderbirds fly when I was a kid prior to going to the Academy. And I had an interaction when I was a cadet at the Air Force Academy, seeing a Thunderbird jet go racing by over the Terrazzo at the Academy, the very moment that I was really wondering why I was there. And it reinvigorated my desire to push and to keep that opportunity to go and fly a fighter aircraft open for myself. But I had transitioned to the Air Force Reserve after I came home from a combat tour in Iraq. And I had a son. He was about 2.5 years old. I was working a traditional reserve position, and I was working on the flight manuals for the F-16 for all the foreign military sales. And it was like late at night, and I saw the mail sitting on the counter, and I opened up the Citizen Airman magazine. And in there, there was an article about the first reservist pilot to be hired to the Thunderbirds, and his name was Stroker Gustafson. So that kind of lit a spark in me as a pretty new mom and all the sleepless nights and everything that goes along with it. And that's when I decided to apply for the Thunderbirds. And interesting enough, the robot mailer that sends out the notification didn't send it to me as a reservist, but one of my friends saw it and she was like, "Hey, I knew you were interested in this." And so I applied. And the doors had been opened by Major Gustafson, and he was actually working at headquarters for the Air Force Reserve Command. So when I got selected, there was a lot of work that went into creating that job position for me to be able to go to the team. But it was a real dream to get to go back and fly. And I strongly believe in helping others who have that goal who come after us, because we are an all-volunteer force. And less than 1% of Americans raise their hand and swear an oath to defend the Constitution and to serve in the Department of Defense. I was really honored to be able to do that. And I was also the first mom ever to fly with the Thunderbirds. So I would get asked a lot if I was the first woman pilot. And I would say no, but my son's the first kid who gets to watch his mom fly in an advanced jet demonstration. It was a really, it was awesome. It was a great tour. And it was funny because the Air Force was going through a total force integration. And some people were halfway through like our first season before they even realized that I was wearing an Air Force Reserve Command patch on my green flight suit instead of the ACC patch. So it was really neat just to show how integration and I was a little bit older than most reservists, but I came with a lot more aviation experience and kind of those things that you look to that Reserve Corps for, that a little bit additional experience and flying experience and judgment and just helping out with the unit. So it was wonderful.
That's amazing. Can I jump in here? I love the fact that your friend told you about that email or message that was pushed out there, only because you said it out loud, told the world what you were trying to achieve, and you know it comes back. So I always believe the more people you tell what you're trying to do, it makes the pathway easier sometimes when it comes back and people remember that thought or that message that was your goal. And I think that really made a difference for you. And then also what we have in common, we were both moms and we were pilots at the same time. So I had a 3.5-year-old before I even joined the Air Force. But being a mom and a flyer is something that is doable for a lot of women. And I think you and I showed other female pilots that you can still have an aviation career and still be a mom and have a family life as well.
Absolutely.
And for you, Colonel Custodio, that added element of it as being the first Hispanic female flyer, what does that mean for you to, in a way, represent so many folks on that journey?
To me, I'm always proud of my heritage, and I encourage people, as we all have different backgrounds and different legacies that our family passes on to us. But I'm proud to have represented the Hispanic community in the military in this field. I wasn't looking to be the first Hispanic. I was just looking for the opportunity to serve my country, and then to find the opportunity to become an Air Force pilot is amazing. But now I know that I do represent this Hispanic community, and I feel that it's my turn to give back, to inspire this generation coming up, that they too can serve their country in any capacity at this point.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the ways that things have changed so much in the past few decades, is the representation for so many different types of people has dramatically increased. And so I would ask both of you, have you experienced now, you know, that your legacy of service is out there and known, have you experienced folks approaching you and expressing that you helped inspire them and move them along to pursue something that they thought maybe wasn't possible? Colonel Jensen, I'll let you go first on that one.
Yeah, I just wanted to really highlight how Lieutenant Colonel Custodio and other women, she's not that much further ahead of me, but she was also in the generation that they didn't have fighter cockpits open to her. And they're always just so humble and just bragging on her too. She was the first woman to get to fly the T-38 at Laughlin Air Force Base, which was my first assignment also. So I've walked in her footsteps. But to go in not only as the first Hispanic person, but the only woman flying in the squadron as an instructor at the time, she did a lot of firsts. And I've had a couple firsts here and there, but a lot of times if I wasn't the first, I was the only woman involved. But the work that she put in and the expertise that she brought and the how competent she was and what an amazing pilot she was, that was what was able to change the whole tide of Congress and leadership to allow all roles to be opened up to women in military aviation. Just want to brag on her and also thank her. And I'm still inspired today, and I've retired 3 years ago, getting to talk to her and being considered somewhere near her level, because she's pretty amazing.
Thank you. Thank you, Blaze. I appreciate that. But I am inspired by this generation and Blaze's generation as well, that they, you know, persevered and went after things that for me weren't possible, but they were able to achieve it. And I'm very jealous of the fact that she flew the Thunderbirds. I wish I could have had that opportunity, but it's okay. We all have our part in going forward and showing this generation that we are capable, women are capable of doing anything that they put their minds to. And just her showing her capability and to be a demonstration pilot is something extraordinary. And be the first mom. And I'm always bragging on moms because we multitask all the time, right?
Yep. And I wanted to add too that the climate was and the culture was definitely very difficult and interesting. And you want to go in and you don't want to stand out because you want to be just like everybody else, but then you're also very different. And in the early 90s, when Congress was talking about opening up more roles to women, and I think they left out some of the other ground combat positions, but they were looking towards the Air Force. The chief of staff at the time testified before Congress that he would rather have a less qualified man flying on his wing than a woman. So that was the culture of the time. And that was like the leadership, the chief of staff of the Air Force was putting that out there. And that was what we were facing. So you almost didn't have a choice but to just put your head down, lead by example, do your best, and make sure that you didn't mess it up for anyone coming after you.
Absolutely. And for my time, I mean, being a first in many positions that I held, and like Blaise said, being the only woman as well, it was quite challenging. But I think the biggest thing that helped me, I guess the fact that I was married and had a kid already, so that's one thing in my life I didn't have to worry about. And I always saw myself as an equal to everybody. I was older as well. And so just a little bit mature for the group when I went through pilot training and moving forward, I was the same age as my supervisors and commanders in the flight. So I guess it helped for me to feel like an equal. obviously rank was significant, but it, as a person, I felt that confidence of when they did it, I can too. So I think that helped me. And the fact that I was a mom, it just gives you more patience with people.
I want to dive in a little bit more to sentiments that both of you were expressing there about the resistance, the difference in culture at the beginning or earlier in your journeys of service. Because I think for those serving now, the culture, we still obviously have a long way to go and a much improvement to be made, or things can always be better. But I think it's so what both of you may have experienced, it might be quite foreign to service members who maybe only have a year or two in service now. So starting with you, Colonel Custodio, if you could tell us a little bit about that resistance that you faced as you were trying to move forward in your career and pursue your goals and dreams.
I know I can talk to that, being the only woman and being the first in the squadron and in the positions I held. It attests to the leadership for me. It boils down to that, like Blaise was talking about. If the leadership sets that tone across the board, but I was very fortunate that the commanders that I worked for were very open to having me there. I'm assuming that they were going to make sure that they set me up for success, but I have to say that you have to work more than your male counterpart just to make sure that you show that you can do the job. You don't ask for any favors, any exclusions or anything. So you step up just like every peer that is with you in the squadron and any job that you're doing. And I think the fact that we were able to do that just shows that. But the culture, well, this culture right now that I experienced and Blaise experienced and they're experiencing now, it's going to take decades to change. You know, people don't like change, but it's going to take a while. And I think until we get the leadership to look and be open to change, I think that's the key to make sure that it's all inclusive and everybody has that opportunity.
Yeah. And I agree wholeheartedly. I definitely learned a lot of leadership lessons from some pretty bad bosses, but at the same time, there were some really wonderful like advocates and allies who made sure that I got considered for different jobs and pushed forward for awards and everything, just the same as my male counterparts. Yeah, and a lot of them are in the San Antonio area now. Maybe some retirees listening there know who they are. Pretty awesome bosses. But I think one of the most interesting obstacles and part of the culture, you heard her say, you don't really want to ask for anything special. But at the same time, the flight equipment that we had was not necessarily made for women. It was nearly impossible to relieve yourself in a cockpit with the flight suits that we had, and the male piddle packs don't work for women. And when we got our G suits, they don't take into account your hips. This air bladder is now pushing up against your rib cage and into your lungs when you're pulling G's, which is against what you want. You want to be able to breathe when you're under G. There were women whose faces were too small, the mask wouldn't fit. I actually worked on the Boeing T-7A Red Hawk program, and one of the cool things about that aircraft is that the seat has more adjustability, so it can accommodate a lot different kinds of body types, but that we didn't have that back then. One of the really interesting cultural things is, man, it's dangerous. I can tell you the fly and approach to minimums in Kunsan Air Base when you drank a whole bunch of water before you flew, and now you're flying down to Minsk and you've had to go to the bathroom for the last 30 minutes. And those things can really affect the mission. It seems novel, but we had to go out there and ask that and those questions, and we worked amongst ourselves for what the best methods were to deal with some of those issues.
Who did you talk to, Blaise? Did you have other women to say, hey, how'd you handle this or that? Because I had no one. I just dealt with what I had. In your time frame, I'm sure there were more women, not that they were with you, but that you knew that went to the academy and were doing something similar to this.
We actually, like the women fighter pilots, started a Facebook page And that's where we could get together and talk to each other. I know the first three women that were selected in April of 1993, like they barely talked to each other. And we just passed their 30-year anniversary. And I think they were all together in one place for the first time 30 years later since the time that they were announced at the Pentagon as being the first three women. And I went to my first fighter assignment in 2000, and I was in Korea in 2005. And I think if you gave me a line number, I was probably one of the first 50 women. So they hired three, and then they put like 20, 25 more into the mix. And then they just let the training play itself out. And so there weren't a lot of women going in. So we were able to, because of technology, thankfully, then get together and ask those questions. And then I was really forthcoming going in my aircrew flight equipment shop. And one of the guys actually was like, "Hey, ma'am, I got three different kinds of like piddle packs." And so he was great. Like he was trying all sorts of different things. And I was like, that's awesome, because not everybody can use the same thing in the same way. Like some people might a different method of being able to do bladder relief during flight. So that young sergeant went on to his next assignment, was able to have, hey, here's three or four different options, and have those on hand for the women that came through the squadron. So that was pretty cool. And then other things, like they were really weird with birth control and birth control changes. And we were getting grounded for 30 days if you changed your birth control. Just, it was like very kind of dark ages. I had even heard at one point that someone said they were afraid that when, and this was like back in the 1900s, if women went flying, they thought their uterus might fall out. Oh, hilarious. You know, so there were all these precautions, and now they are letting women fly even in fighters, like through their first trimester. So much has changed. Yeah, it's really great to see the changes and the different capabilities and options for women today.
I did get pregnant while I was flying the T-38, and I was grounded immediately. So I didn't tell anybody for a little bit. I'm like, I think I'm pregnant. I'm not going to say anything because I know that I'll be grounded for the next 10 months. And I was like, So the flight surgeon was like, "You're going to be the first here. Let's see what we need to do." So it was like all like that. But we didn't even have flight suits. They would not even invest any money in getting us flight suits. I was excited when the first female flight cap came along. Man, I was all over that. So that's pretty good. And I know that they've had new flight suits for women now. I don't know how they fit or anything like that, but I think most women are happy because they made them a little smaller and wider where needed to be. But I think those things making the job a little bit easier with everything. Women had to advocate for themselves and amongst themselves, like Glaze, the Facebook page. So I thought that was pretty awesome.
So both of you sharing those experiences, great changes in the Air Force over the time that you served, not only on the topic of gender and the opportunities available to women. What are some other changes during your service that kind of stand out to you? Colonel Jensen, if you want to go ahead.
Those things were really hard. I actually did a event, like a speaking event at Maxwell with this SOS there, and they were like, "What did you change that made things better for everyone after you?" And I was like, man, I felt like I just was like holding on. Was said previously, we had to be twice as good and the stakes were twice as high too if we didn't pass. So a lot of my time was just like trying to be me. But it's funny that you mentioned the flight cap, because I know Nicole Malachowski, the first woman Thunderbird, was totally under the microscope. They'd been faxing her grade sheets at the end of every day to four-star generals and all sorts of craziness, which does not happen at all today. But she had a woman's flight cap on and went to an air show. And one of the generals was like, "That looks terrible. She looks like totally different than everyone else. And she is different. She's a lot shorter too, and a woman, obviously." And they wanted her to put on the male flight cap. And she said, "I'm representing all these women and the standards. Like, I can't just go and wear something out of uniform." And so they actually changed the uniform reg to allow women to choose which flight cap they wanted.
Great. No, how would I say? If you know the rules, you can stand on the principle. It says, this is what it says, and that's what I'm doing. It's not like you're trying to break the rules. And then that's how you make change, when you stand up for what you believe is right and what the reg says. They I guess you caught him on that, the flight cap.
Yeah, definitely a lesson there of regulation is regulation for a reason. And if you know it, then you generally are going to have the upper hand. Keying in on moments like that where you see that resistance firsthand and that sort of being singled out for your gender, in those difficult moments when it felt like doors were closed or people were against you in a certain way, what are some things that you drew on that gave you strength to keep pushing through? Colonel Custodio, if you want to lead us off on that one.
Oh, sure. Everyone has a defining moment in their careers. Mine came early on when I had a bird strike, and I proved that I was going to be a good pilot because I was able to handle the emergency, all the procedures, everything I'd learned to that point. And it just bumped up that confidence for me. What I saw was that I had what it took to be a good pilot. So I held on to that. And then, like I said before, I saw myself as an equal. And the strong values that I learned from my father, and as well as any student that I would teach in pilot training, I would tell them, you have to have some kind of talent to be a pilot. But motivation, to me, it's 85 to 90%. If you're motivated to pursue a goal, that's going to get you over those challenges. And then you learn from when you don't do as well, and you build on that. So to me, quitting was never an option. So I had to make sure I gave myself every opportunity to continue. And I would, like Lay said, you have to find your allies. You have to ask for help if you don't know. And those advocates and allies that you find and your mentors is a huge differentiator, because it's sometimes a moment of, am I going to overcome this challenge, or how am I going to get through this challenge? And there you find your mentors and allies to help you with that. So looking for them, acknowledging them, and knowing that you can't do this all by yourself, I think is what's huge for me as far as getting through these challenges.
And I'll add to that, and actually the way that Olga and I met for the first time was at or around the women Air Force service pilots, the World War II WASP, who trained at Avenger Field. And I think that's when she and I first met each other, was at an event for them. But when I wanted to fly fighters, and it wasn't allowed for 7 years after I had made that goal for myself as a young girl, I learned about the story of the WASP in World War II. And that just always kept me going. They flew from September of 1942, and they were disbanded in December of 1944. And there were just over 1,100 women who got to fly airplanes, all the airplanes in the inventory, all the missions except for combat. But to have this great opportunity and then have it just pulled out from underneath them, and they were told to go home on their own expense and to not tell anybody what they did, and their records were marked classified and secret and hidden for 30 years until the military announced, oh, our first women military pilots. And the WASP stood up and said, hey, what about me? There were so many times in my life where I was like having a hard time. And I was like, those women would just give anything to be like sitting where I'm sitting. And somebody had told me she was having a really hard time in command and somehow ran into a WASP at an event at the base or something. And I was looking for mentorship from this World War II veteran and said, I just don't know if I can do this anymore. I'm having a really hard time. And the WASP looked her straight in the eye and said, they made us quit. Like, why would you voluntarily leave? And what a great thing. But I really, one of the most like solidified memories that I have from my time in the service was sitting at the end of the runway at Hill Air Force Base in a sick ship of F-16s. We're about to take off to deploy to Iraq. We're stopping in Rome, Spain. It was like a 10.5-hour flight. And all I could think of was the WASP. It was like dark. There was one of my squadron mates was standing at the end of the row with he had a flashlight on an American flag, and the guys up in the tower had an American flag with a tower light on it. And it's just like, I'm getting goosebumps talking about it. But all I could think of was how many of those women would have given anything to be there in my place, how many of them would have been so amazing at it. And because of their service and because of women like Volvo too, that I was able to do that. I was just so grateful to have that experience and help kind of culminate and further women in aviation that way was really special.
Yeah, those women were amazing, and I had the opportunity to meet several of them as well. They helped us start the Women Military Aviators Association when we founded it here at Randolph, and it was an amazing opportunity to sit with them and see how just incredible. They shared so many experiences and stories with us. And we went to Indianapolis and we did the first all-female four-ship flyby over the Indianapolis Speedway for our first Women Military Aviators Convention. And the WASPs were there with us to support. It was pretty awesome. So yeah, those moments are incredible. And to hear your story, I could just visualize it as you're telling that story, Blaze. It's like I was there with you. Wow. And amazing. I have goosebumps as well. You were in a way.
Absolutely. And being a history nerd myself, hearing you, Colonel Jensen, specifically cite like a historic example of where a source of motivation for you is pretty amazing. And for me, getting this opportunity to speak to both of you who have contributed to the history of the Air Force, you've already both shared so many great points that are good takeaways for people. But any specific piece of advice, closing thought, if somebody asked you, let's say a young lady trying to go through the same path that either of you carved, what would you say to them? Colonel Custodio, if you want to go first.
Absolutely. As I mentioned, the challenges that you overcome give you perspective, but you first of all have to show up. You just can't have things come to you. You need to go find them and show up. Always be prepared. I think that's key to helping overcome those challenges. And experiences always build your confidence. But I want to tell these young ladies, it's okay to be smart. It's okay to stand out, because sometimes they just want to fit in, but it's okay for that. And I think my mantra as a Hispanic female is querer es poder, meaning where there's a will, there's power. And I think everyone has that will within them. They just need to find it and use it. So
I would say to expect obstacles and expect setbacks, and you gain your courage with how you handle failures and difficulties. And there are plenty of times in my life, like when I was in high school, I had a teacher who failed me on a paper because I said I wanted to be a fighter pilot someday. I had guidance counselors, like when the cadets from West Point and Annapolis and the Air Force Academy would come to the guidance counselor's office, I'd hear about it a day later, and they knew I wanted to go to the Air Force Academy. And then I majored in English at the Air Force Academy. I'm not very STEM brained. I always like to say I love STEM, but STEM doesn't love me back. Like, people will say, oh, you have to be good at math and you have to be able to run a mile in 7 minutes. Or you have to, like, all of these things. Some of them are true, but a lot of them aren't. And so don't let anyone put any false restrictions on you. Don't put any false restrictions on yourself. If you think that you can do something, like, expect to hit roadblocks. But how you handle them will make you stronger and will help you be catapulted to success and to what you want to do.
Absolutely. Well, I always like to end with that question of, is there anything else you'd like to add?
For me, I just want to say I'm very proud to have served my country, to be a veteran, and I was proud to wear the uniform, and any opportunity that I have to wear it, I will. And that's what I think is love of country to me.
And I always like to encourage people to reach out to people who've done what they do. And there's a phrase out there that I really like it, and that's, you have to see it to be it. But then I think about women like Olga, who became something that she couldn't see necessarily, or she found similarities in her father or other people that were serving and took qualities of different leaders into her own style of leadership. So I just encourage people to think outside of the box and really look for mentors in whatever it is you want to do and go for it.
First of all, I appreciate both of you for coming on and sharing your stories. And I hope that it serves to inspire anyone listening to this podcast to realize that just because someone tells you no, doesn't mean you can't do it. So retired Lieutenant Colonel Olga Custodio, retired Lieutenant Colonel Caroline Jensen, thank you so much for your time on this podcast, and best of luck in what comes next.
Thank you, Julian. This was fun. I could do this with Caroline.
I know. Let's go on the road.
If you'd like to see more about Lieutenant Colonels Custodio and Jansen's visit to Starbase Kelly, check out our Facebook page for pictures. Some announcements for the upcoming UTA. There will be a series of stand-up meetings on Saturday, November 2nd to discuss a recently released task order regarding the integration of risk and readiness. This is a mandatory event for all airmen. The meeting will be held at the Bob Hope Theater. The maintenance and medical group are scheduled for 0815, wing staff and the operations group meet at 10, and the mission support group is at 1300. Breakout sessions will follow the meetings. Look for more information from your leadership. The Sapper and Suicide Prevention Training scheduled for Saturday has been moved to Sunday at 09 because of the stand-up meetings. The location is still the Bob Hope Theater. DEOX surveys are now available for airmen to submit their feedback about conditions at their units. A link has been sent to your military emails. Please complete it as soon as possible. Flu shots are now available for airmen. TRICARE beneficiaries can receive them during the week at Wilford Hall. The 433rd Medical Group will also be offering flu shots during this UTA. Look for more information from your leadership. And that's going to do it for this episode of Ready, Set, Airlift. As always, thank you for taking time to listen in. Remember to check out our website, Facebook, or Instagram pages for the latest Alamo Wing news. And don't forget to subscribe or like the podcast on whichever platform you like to listen on. I've been your host, Julian Hernandez. Until next time, stay safe and have a great UTA.